My name is Bill Erdrock. I'm from Oshkosh, Wisconsin. I'm not an expert on Thomas Jefferson. My background really is in biblical studies, particularly Hebrew Bible. And I did my my work in ancient Near Eastern civilizations and languages, and as I say, Hebrew Bible. But because I've been teaching in a state-supported or largely funded by the state university for the last 15 years, since 1972 at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh, I have perforce become very interested in the relationship between church and state, particularly in matters of education and higher education, and especially the questions that people always ask, what's it like to teach religion at a public institution, and what's the difference between the academic teaching of religion, for example, and the doctrinal teaching for religion that might happen in a seminary or in a church-related group. And so because of some of that and some of my interest in some of the recent Supreme Court decisions that relate to religion and education, I became more and more interested in looking into the First Amendment, looking into some of the ideas that surrounded the founding of our country and some of the ideas about religion, for example, that found their way into the federal constitution, and also the religion clauses in the Wisconsin state constitution, the state in which I happen to be teaching. The idea for this course comes partly out of that, and partly because, as you all know, we're in the bicentennial year of our Constitution. Constitution Day is September 17th this year. That was the day in 1787, after a whole summer of wrangling, that the delegates who were still there at the convention, because delegates were also in and out, as you know, those who were still there, with a couple of dissenters who refused to sign, actually did the signing and presented this document to the 13 states for individual ratification by the states. And I think you know that that also took quite some time, and there were papers and articles written on both sides to try and persuade state delegations to either okay or not okay the Constitution. So even though we're celebrating this year as Constitution Year, it really wasn't ratified for some time afterwards. And of course, the First Amendment, which is my major focus during this week and my greatest interest, was not adopted until sometime later too. You're aware of the fact that some of the states decided they would only ratify the Constitution on the condition that one of the very first orders of business of the Congress under the new Constitution would be to add a Bill of Rights. You're probably also aware of the fact that Jefferson was not in the United States during the Constitutional Convention. He was serving at that time as our ambassador in Paris. However, he was in some correspondence with James Madison, who was one of the leading lights at the Constitutional Convention and had a great deal of influence. And Jefferson, in his letters back to Madison, said as one of his criticisms that he was very sorry that there was not yet a Bill of Rights, and he really did want a Bill of Rights very soon. So you can see that I'm kind of finessing to do Jefferson during the Constitutional Year. He's sort of on the edges in some ways, but I think he's important. I would also like to share one other reason why I chose to do Jefferson here at Holden this week. When I had the privilege of coming to Holden for the first time 2 years ago, I did 10 sessions on two books by Phyllis Trible. Phyllis Trible is a feminist theologian, I guess you could call her a theologian. She's really more a biblical scholar than a theologian. But she's written two very striking books dealing with texts from the Hebrew Bible and reading them from a feminist perspective. And one of the chapters I did then was her chapter on Hagar, and I thought that was striking that Norm Hobble did Hagar reading from the bottom yesterday. And I found that those sessions were very invigorating to a lot of people because they were very controversial. In fact, they were so invigorating that we had some very good arguments as a result. And from what I understand, that's part of what Holden is supposed to be about. That the sort of community that's supposed to develop at Holden is not supposed to be a marshmallow community. It's supposed to be a community that's built on some real sharing of, you know, even places where we have deep cleavages in our understandings and real deep differences. Because if you can't make a community over those differences, you probably ought to give up anyway. So I come with Jefferson to present him to you with some fear and trembling. I would guess that there are some Jefferson devotees in the group, and I would guess there are probably many of you who don't know Jefferson at all, who only know Jefferson the way I knew Jefferson up till 3 or 4 years ago. He's a famous person, Declaration of Independence. There's a statue in this beautiful rotunda for him in Washington with cherry trees around, and you can go and visit Monticello, and isn't it neat? He did a lot of inventions, you know, and that's Jefferson. And I don't know how many of us remember what an incredibly controversial figure he was in his time, and especially for his religious views. Jefferson was not only not a traditional Christian and not a Trinitarian, he was vehemently not a traditional Christian and vehemently not a Trinitarian. He was, on the other hand, a very strong admirer of Jesus of Nazareth. And he was quite convinced that the Christian religion had been horribly disfigured since the original teachings of Jesus. And so he was in his time, and especially among the clergy, and particularly the clergy of New England while he was president, he was greatly vilified. And he was much hated. And Jefferson, for his part, he never pulled back in what he had to say either. But he didn't often discuss his religion in public. Most of it comes in his private correspondence, in his letters. And so I wanted to present Jefferson to you because I think one of my dreams for Holden, the other night someone asked the staff people if they had dreams. And if I would have a dream for Holden and the Holden community, it would be that it would do even more reaching out from its Christian perspective. I think it's important to have your own stance and your own center. But to do even more reaching out towards those who are not Christians and those who aren't the kind of Orthodox Trinitarian Christians most people at Holden are used to dealing with and being with. And I think the strength of Holden will increase manyfold as it listens more to Hindus, as Norm mentioned last night, and to Buddhists, and to Native Americans, who are here this week, and to Jews, and to all those other strange kinds of Christians who don't look like most of the rest of us. So that much for background about why I want to do a week on Thomas Jefferson. I'm going to do that this week, and we're going to repeat it 2 weeks hence, and it'll bring us right up to the 4th of July, so that'll be sort of serendipitous, I think. These are the topics also that I'm going to cover this week. Today, just in general, to talk about Thomas Jefferson's religion, and I'm going to look particularly at three things. His notes on the state of Virginia, which was the one book of sorts that he wrote during his life. Then I want to talk just a little bit about his attempt to put together a compendium of the life and morals of Jesus, which is really his sort of documentary hypothesis in a way that he put into practice long before a person like Bultmann. Jefferson was demythologizing the New Testament and cutting and pasting and extracting the true words of Jesus from all the other editions that had been put on either by evangelists or editors and those he felt were really not presenting Jesus' doctrine correctly. And then I want to also look at just a couple of pieces of correspondence, particularly one letter that he wrote to his nephew, Peter Carr, when Peter was 17 years old, giving him advice as to how he should go about now developing a more mature understanding of religion. He was at the point now where he should be giving up some of his childish views and ought to kind of be moving on into the future. So first of all, I want to look at Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia, his one book of sorts that he wrote during his life. And I'm going to read at some length because I want you to get a flavor for Jefferson's own words and his own writing. This was a very interesting little book that Jefferson wrote. He wrote it in response to some questions that were put to him by the French ambassador or consul, I forget which, who was living in Philadelphia. And this person asked Jefferson several questions about his home state, the Commonwealth of Virginia. And would Jefferson give him a little history about his Commonwealth and what it was like being a Virginian? And so Jefferson wrote this really neat little book. It's 100 pages or so long. And it covers everything about his home state, the boundaries, the rivers, seaports, mountains, cascades, productions, mineral, vegetable, and animal, climate, population, military force, marine force, the aborigines, counties and towns, the constitution of the Commonwealth, its laws, its colleges, buildings, and roads, proceedings as to Tories, religion, manners, manufacturers, subjects of commerce, weights, measures, and money, public revenue and expenses, and histories, memorials, and state papers. Rather neat little piece. He wrote it in the year 1781, re-edited it, revised it in 1782, and finally saw it published in 1787. This was also a difficult time for Jefferson because he had just come through being governor of Virginia. Think of the date, 1781. This was after the Continental Congress, first and second, after he had worked on the Declaration of Independence. And he was then chosen governor of Virginia in 1779. And during his 2 years as governor, horrible things happened in Virginia. Benedict Arnold's troops invaded, finally Cornwallis. Jefferson himself was driven even from Monticello. And there was even some talk about people bringing proceedings against Jefferson for not managing the defense of the state as well as he should have. Some years later, they actually wrote a resolution to thank him for what he had done as governor during those years. Then he also lost his wife. As this was a difficult time for him, but the writing of this book began to bring him out of it. And then, of course, you know, he was then called in to become ambassador under the Articles of Confederation to France, and that brought him back into public life. But he wrote this while he thought he had retired from public life. Well, something of what he said about religion in his home state of Virginia. When he says country, he means the state of Virginia. This is in answer to question number 17. The question was, What are some of the different religions that have been received into this state? And Jefferson writes, the first settlers in this country were emigrants from England of the English church, just at a point in time when it was flushed with complete victory over the religions of all other persuasions. Possessed, as they became, of the powers of making, administering, and executing the laws, they showed equal intolerance in this country, namely Virginia, with their Presbyterian brethren who had emigrated to the northern governance, those are the Puritans in New England. The poor Quakers were flying from persecution in England. They cast their eyes on these new countries as asylums of civil and religious freedom, but they found them free only for the reigning sect. Several acts of the Virginia Assembly of 1659, 1662, and 1693 had made it penal in parents to refuse to have their children baptized, had prohibited the unlawful assembling of Quakers, had made it penal for any master of a vessel to bring a Quaker into the state, had ordered those already here and such as should come thereafter to be imprisoned till they should abjure the country, provided a milder punishment for their first and second return, but death for their third, had inhibited all persons from suffering their meetings in or near their houses, entertaining them individually, or disposing of books which supported their tenets. The Anglicans retained full possession of the country, Virginia, for about a century. Well, then he talks about how other persuasions began to come in, and he says, the present state of our laws on the subject of religion is this. The convention of May 1776, so just a few months before the Declaration of Independence at the Federal Convention, State Convention, May 1776, in their Declaration of Rights, declared it to be a truth and a natural right that the exercise of religion should be free. Later, that same convention, when they met as a member of the General Assembly in October 1776, repealed all acts of Parliament, English acts, which had rendered criminal the maintaining any opinions in matters of religion, the forbearing to repair to church. In other words, it was criminal not to go to church. And the Virginia legislature in October 1776 overturned that. It was no longer a criminal offense not to go to church. They overturned that criminality. They suspended the laws which gave salaries to the clergy, which suspension was then made perpetual in October 1779. And now comes Jefferson's opinion about this, and this is what's important. Statutory oppressions in religion being thus wiped away. Notice he calls those oppressions, statutory oppressions. We remain at present only under those imposed by the common law or by our own acts of assembly. And then he goes on to mention that there actually were some ideas in common law that made it a heresy not to follow the Trinitarian form of the Christian religion, and which also made it an offense if you had been raised a Trinitarian to abjure that later on. By our own act of assembly, then, he says, too, in 1705, if a person brought up in the Christian religion denies the being of a God or the Trinity, or asserts there are more gods than one, or denies the Christian religion to be true, or the scriptures to be a divine authority, that person is punishable on the first offense by incapacity to hold any office or employment, ecclesiastical, civil, or military. On the second, by disability to sue, to take any gift or legacy, to be a guardian, an executor, an administrator, and by 3 years imprisonment without bail. A father's right to the custody of his own children being founded in law on this right of guardianship, this being taken away, they may, of course, be severed from him and put by the authority of a court into more orthodox hands. This is a summary view of that religious slavery under which a people have been willing to remain, who have lavished their lives and fortunes for the establishment of their civil freedom. Obviously, Jefferson is pumping here and pushing for getting rid of these ideas as well. And that, of course, you know, finally made its way into the U.S. Constitution, which we'll talk about later this week. There was an idea that if you held certain religious views, or if you gave up certain religious views, then there were all sorts of civil rights which you were not entitled to, including the holding of office, but also being able to be a guardian, even over your own children. Then Jefferson goes on, and again, we get his view of the matter here. The error seems not efficiently eradicated, that the operation of the mind may be subject to the coercion of the laws, just as are the acts of the body. But our rulers can have authority over such natural rights only as we have submitted to them. The rights of conscience we never submitted, we could not submit. We are answerable for them only to our God. The legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others. But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no God. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. If it be said his testimony in a court of justice cannot be relied on, well then reject it and be the stigma on him. But constraint may make a person worse by making him into a hypocrite. It will never make him a truer person. It may fix him obstinately in his errors, but will not cure them. Reason and free inquiry are the only effectual agents against error. I think you could say that was one of the mottos of Jefferson's personal philosophy. Reason and free inquiry are the only effectual agents against error. Give a loose to them, to reason and free inquiry. They will support the true religion by bringing every false one to their tribunal, to the test of their investigation. They, namely reason and free inquiry, are the natural enemies of error and of error only. It is error alone which needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself. And then he goes on to talk about, well, what about the problem, though, if everybody has all these opinions, and isn't this going to really mess up a civil society? Aren't we all supposed to have uniformity? And I think many of you are aware of the fact how this was fought over just in the century or so before this in Europe, especially during the 17th century, during the 30 Years' War. Where they finally had the decision after the peace that, you know, if the prince was a Roman Catholic, then everyone in that prince's territory was a Roman Catholic. If you weren't, you could move. And they may or may not let you take your family with you. If the prince in the territory was a Lutheran, then everybody in the territory would be a Lutheran. If not, you had to move. If the prince was a Calvinist, everybody in the territory had to be a Calvinist. If not, you could move. If you were a Baptist, you had no place to go. The Lutherans didn't want you, the Romans didn't want you, the Calvinists didn't want you. Everyone persecuted you. There was a feeling, you know, they had moved, in other words, from the idea of only one church everywhere, now to, well, you can have different churches, but it at least has to be only one church in any particular place, right? as goes the shepherd, goes, so goes the shop, flock, is one of the little sayings. Now he says, is uniformity of opinion really desirable? No more than of face and stature. Difference of opinion is actually advantageous in religion. The several sects perform the office of a censor morum over each other. Each one acts like a censor over the morals of the others, and that's a good thing. Is uniformity even attainable? Millions of innocent men, women, and children, since the introduction of Christianity, have been burnt, tortured, fined, imprisoned, yet we have not advanced one inch towards uniformity. What has been the effect of coercion? To make one half the world fools and the other half hypocrites. To support roguery and error all over the earth. But every state, someone will say, has established some religion. But no two, say I in reply, have established the same. And so is this a proof of the infallibility of establishments? Our sister states of Pennsylvania and New York, however, have long subsisted without any establishment of religion at all. The experiment was new and doubtful when they made it. It has answered beyond conception. They flourish infinitely. Religion is well supported, of various kinds indeed, but all good enough, all sufficient to preserve peace and order. Or if a sect arises whose tenets would subvert morals, good sense has fair play and reason and laughs it out of doors without suffering the state to be troubled with it. They do not hang more malefactors than we do. They are not more disturbed with religious dissensions than we are. On the contrary, their harmony is unparalleled and can be ascribed to nothing but their unbounded tolerance, because there is no other circumstance in which they differ from every nation on earth. They have made the happy discovery that the way to silence religious disputes is to take no notice of them. Let us too give this experiment fair play and get rid while we may of those tyrannical laws. It is true we are as yet secured against them by the spirit of the times. I doubt whether the people of this country would suffer an execution for heresy or a 3 years imprisonment any longer for someone who cannot comprehend the mysteries of the Trinity. But is the spirit of the people, he really means now sort of like the emotional tide at any given time, public opinion, is the spirit of the people an infallible, a permanent reliance? Is it government? In other words, the people in office at any time. Is this the kind of protection we receive in return for the rights we give up? The spirit of the times may alter, will alter. A single zealot may commence persecutor, and better men be his victims. It can never be too often repeated that the time for fixing every essential right on a legal basis is while our rulers are honest and we ourselves are united. From the conclusion of this war, we shall surely be going downhill. It will not then be necessary to resort every moment to the people for support. They will be forgotten, therefore, and their rights will be disregarded. They will forget themselves, but in the sole faculty of making money, and will never think of uniting to effect a due respect for their rights. The shackles, therefore, which shall not be knocked off at the conclusion of this war, will remain on us long, will be made heavier and heavier, till our rights shall revive or expire in a convulsion. Well, I think you start to get a flavor there of Jefferson. Now, it's interesting to me that Jefferson was convinced that his ideas for the free range of opinion, and his ideas that it really didn't matter that much what your opinions were in religion, so long as you could be trusted to live a moral life in society. He was quite convinced that those ideas were also the ideas of Jesus. He was also quite convinced that his own affinity, Jefferson's own affinity towards Unitarianism, which was being espoused now by several people, including, for example, Joseph Priestley in England. In the early 1800s, he and Priestley had a correspondence. Remember the discoverer of oxygen? And Priestley was a Unitarian. And Jefferson was very much drawn towards Unitarianism, and he saw the beginnings of Unitarianism also in New England. And he was quite convinced that Jesus was a Unitarian. I was bemused, not amused, but bemused the other night during Eucharist. This is an aside. But when the text was written from the end of Matthew, when it said that there were some who prostrated themselves to Jesus, and there are others who were doubters and would not. And then Jesus goes on and says, all authority is given to be in heaven and earth, etc., and baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I have to be convinced that whenever you read sections like that in the Christian Bible, that those are political, just as when you read other sections similar to this in the Hebrew Bible, and that there clearly is a recognition there that there were large numbers of early Christians who were Unitarians, as it were, who accepted Jesus as the anointed one of God, but certainly were not about to prostrate themselves to him as if he were God present. The text in Matthew, of course, says they should get over those feelings, and they should become those who recognize that all authority has been given to Jesus on heaven and earth, like those of us who've made that move. But it's fairly obvious that there were large numbers of early followers of Jesus who did not consider Jesus a divine being among them. Jefferson obviously shared that thought too. I want to talk a bit about Jefferson's, so if we can switch direction a little bit now. I want to talk a bit about Jefferson's project in trying to put together what he called the life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. And this is some correspondence that comes a little later now in his life. Most of this correspondence comes during his presidency, the early part of his presidency. You remember that under the new Constitution, Washington was elected president twice, which brought him up to around 1796. In 1796, there was the election in which John Adams was elected, and Jefferson was elected vice president. And then during those 4 years, there was a great deal of dissension that developed between the so-called Federalists, Hamilton on the one side, and Adams, and then those who began to call themselves Republicans, like Jefferson. Part of it because of some of the sedition acts that were being written, which were very much against Jefferson's ideas, and the acts that were cutting off freedom of the press, and some of the acts trying to restrict freedom of speech. And so then Jefferson was elected in 1800 and re-elected in 1804. During these years of his presidency, Jefferson also began work on this life and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. And it shows up in some of his correspondence. And I want to just read some of the correspondence from that time leading up to this. And again, we'll give you some sense of his idea of what Christianity was supposed to be like. This is a letter he wrote to Moses Robinson in 1801, just one sentence. The Christian religion, when divested of the rags in which they have enveloped it, and brought back to the original purity and simplicity of its benevolent institutor, namely Jesus, is a religion of all others most friendly to liberty, science, and the freest expressions of the human mind. a religion of all others most friendly to liberty, science, and the freest expansions of the human mind. Here's a letter he wrote in 1803 to Joseph Priestley, over in Priestley, England. To do Jesus justice, it would be necessary to remark the disadvantages his doctrines have to encounter. Not having been committed to writing by himself, but by the most unlettered of men, by memory, long after they had heard them from him, and much was forgotten, much misunderstood, and presented in very paradoxical shapes. Yet such are the fragments remaining as to show a master workman, and that his system of morality was the most benevolent and sublime probably that has ever been taught, and eminently more perfect than those of any of the ancient philosophers. His character and doctrine have revealed still greater injury from those who pretend to be his special disciples, and who have disfigured and sophisticated his actions and precepts from views of personal interest, so as to induce the unthinking part of mankind to throw off the whole system in disgust, and to pass sentence as an impostor on the most innocent, the most benevolent, the most eloquent and sublime character that ever has been exhibited to men. Here's one he wrote after the presidency from Monticello to William Baldwin in 1810, in which he thanks him for a little pamphlet that he had sent to Jefferson. And he agrees with what he wrote in the pamphlet. So Jefferson was obviously not the only one thinking this way at this time. And he says, nothing can be more exactly and seriously true than what is there stated, namely in your pamphlet, Mr. Baldwin, that but a short time had elapsed after the death of the great reformer of the Jewish religion, before his principles were departed from by those who professed to be his special servants, and perverted into an engine for enslaving mankind and aggrandizing their oppressors in church and state. That the purest system of morals ever preached to man has been adulterated and sophisticated by artificial constructions into a mere contrivance to filch wealth and power to themselves. That rational men, not being able to swallow their impious heresies, in order to force them down their throats, they raise the hue and cry of infidelity and heretic, while themselves are the greatest obstacles to the advancement of the real doctrines of Jesus, and do in fact constitute the real Antichrist. Here's one he wrote to who had become his buddy now, former President John Adams, in 1813. He said to John Adams, I remember to have heard Dr. Priestley say that if all England would candidly examine themselves and confess, they would find that Unitarianism was really the religion of all. And I observe a bill is now depending in the English Parliament for the relief of anti-Trinitarians. It is too late in the day for men of sincerity to pretend they believe in the Platonic mysticisms that three are one and one is three and yet one is not three and three are not one. This all constitutes the craft and the power and the profit of the priests. Sweep away their gossamer fabrics of factitious religion and they would catch no more flies. We should all then, like the Quakers, live without an order of priests, moralize for ourselves, follow the oracle of conscience, and say nothing about what no one can understand anyway, nor therefore believe. For I suppose belief to be the assent of the mind to an intelligible proposition. Now that is not an orthodox view of faith. It's very interesting. I suppose belief to be the assent of the mind to an intelligible proposition. This is not faith in mysteries. And you can see here a great gulf. Well, let me read you something now about his feeling about Jesus. one that he wrote to William Canby, another one on Stealing of Jesus, and then I want to give you a brief overview of what he included in his Life and Morals of Jesus. This is written also in 1813 from Monticello. Of all the systems of morality, ancient or modern, which have come under my observation, and he observed many. He was a great admirer of Epictetus, for example, and some of the old Roman philosophers. Of all the systems, ancient or modern, which have come under my observation, none appears to me so pure as that of Jesus. He who follows this steadily need not, I think, be uneasy. Although he cannot comprehend the subtleties and mysteries erected on his doctrines by those who, calling themselves his special followers and favorites, would make him come into the world to lay snares for all understandings but theirs. These metaphysical heads, usurping the judgment seat of God, denounce as his enemies all who cannot perceive the geometrical logic of Euclid in the demonstrations of St. Athanasius that three are one and one is three, and yet that one is not three nor the three one. Notice how he keeps coming back to this? In all essential points, you and I are of the same religion, and I am too old to go into other inquiries and changes and as to all the unessential. Then I want to read a portion of a letter he wrote to Miles King in 1814. Miles King wrote a very impassioned letter to Jefferson that year, in which he begged Jefferson to officially and publicly embrace Jesus Christ as his personal Savior, to be an example to the American people, most of whom were very lacking in a strong religious faith. And he felt that if Jefferson, as a former president, and at least revered by a large portion of the population, would publicly make this profession of, you know, more traditional Orthodox faith and convert to Jesus that way, he would start a great movement in the country. And Jefferson writes a very courteous letter in response to Miles King, but very straightforwardly saying, not at all. Hitherto I have been under the guidance of that portion of reason, which God has thought proper to deal out to me. I have followed it faithfully in all important cases, to such a degree at least, as leaves me without uneasiness. And if on minor occasions I have erred from its dictates, I have trust in him who made us what we are, and know it was not his plan to make us always unerring. He has formed us moral agents. Not that in the perfection of his state he can feel pain or pleasure from anything we may do, he is far above our power. But that we may promote the happiness of those with whom he has placed us in society, by acting honestly towards all, benevolently to those who fall within our way, respecting sacredly their rights, bodily and mental, and cherishing especially their freedom of conscience, as we value our own. I must ever believe that religion substantially good, which produces an honest life, and we have been authorized by one whom you and I equally respect, to judge of the tree by its fruit. Our particular principles of religion are a subject of accountability to our God alone. I inquire after no man's, and trouble none with mine. Nor is it given to us in this life to know whether yours or mine, our friends or our foes, are exactly the right. Nay, we have heard it said that there is not a Quaker or a Baptist, a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian, a Catholic or a Protestant in heaven. That on entering the gate, we leave behind those badges of schism and find ourselves united in those principles only in which God has united us all. Let us not be uneasy then about the different roads we may pursue, as believing them the shortest to that our last abode. but following the guidance of a good conscience. Let us be happy in the hope that by these different paths we shall all meet in the end. And that you and I may there meet and embrace is my earnest prayer. And with this assurance I salute you with brotherly esteem and respect. I've always enjoyed that letter because it is such a wonderful model of A, honesty, but B, courtesy. And I don't know how Miles King replied again to that letter. Now to talk directly on this little book that Jefferson put together for 2 or 3 minutes, and then maybe I want to read the letter to Peter Kahn, and he may have some questions. This is one he wrote to Charles Thompson. I don't know if any of you know Charles Thompson. Charles Thompson was I'm not sure if he was Secretary of State or what other office he had under the Articles of Confederation, I think under one of Washington's first cabinets. But Thompson was a Greek scholar, and he translated the Septuagint into English. And it is still the best one-volume translation, I think, that we have. Of the Septuagint. It's a marvelous piece. It showed you the kind of people that we had in government at that time. Jefferson, by the way, was working with French, Latin, and Greek when he put together this Life and Morals of Jesus. He worked out of the original in the New Testament. He writes to Thompson now, who's himself working on the Greek Old Testament. I too have made a weedy little book from the same materials, which I call The Philosophy of Jesus. It is a little paradigm of his doctrines made by cutting the texts out of the book and rearranging them on the pages of a blank book in a certain order of time or subject. A more beautiful or precious morsel of ethics I have never seen. It is a document in proof that I am a real Christian. That is to say, a disciple of the doctrines of Jesus, very different from all those Platonists who like to call me infidel and themselves Christian and preachers of the gospel, why they draw all their characteristic dogmas from what its author never said nor saw. They have compounded from the heathen mysteries a system beyond the comprehension of a human being, of which the great reformer of the vicious ethics and deism of the Jews, a little anti-Semitism there, were he to return on earth, would not recognize one feature. If I had time, I would add to my little book the Greek, the Latin, and the French texts, all in columns, side by side. And I wish I could also subjoin a translation of Gassendi's Syntagma of the Doctrines of Epicurus, which, notwithstanding the calumnies of the Stoics and the caricatures of Cicero, is the most rational system remaining of the philosophy of the ancients, as frugal of vicious indulgence and fruitful of virtue as the hyperbolical extravagancies of his rival sects. And then he says, I retain good health and wish the same for you. He wrote also to a person named Francis Adrian von der Kemp in 1816 about how he had put this together. And he says again about his little cutting and pasting job, I have made for my own satisfaction an extract from the evangelists of the text of Jesus' morals, selecting those only whose style and spirit prove them genuine and his own. And they are distinguishable from the matter in which they are embedded as diamonds in dunghills. A more precious morsel of ethics was never seen. It was too hastily done, however, being the work of 1 or 2 evenings only while I lived in Washington, overwhelmed with other business. And it is my intention now to go over it again at more leisure. This shall be the work of the next winter. I'm giving it the title of The Philosophy of Jesus Extracted from the Text of the Evangelists, unquote. And to this syllabus and extract, if a history of his life can be added, written with the same view on the subject, the world will see after the fogs shall be dispelled, in which for 14 centuries he's been enveloped by the jugglers to make money of him, when the genuine character shall be exhibited, which they have dressed up in the rags of an impostor. The world, I say, will at length see the immortal merit of this first of human sages. But when he finally put the compendium together, this was the sort of outline that he put together of the doctrines of Jesus. And this was in 1822 that he finally had it arranged the way he wanted it. He wrote to his friend Benjamin Waterhouse again. The doctrines of Jesus are simple, and they tend to the happiness of all. Number one, that there is one God, and he is all perfect. Two, that there is a future state of rewards and punishments. Three, that to love God with all thy heart and thy neighbor as thyself is the sum of religion. These are the great points on which Jesus endeavored to reform the religion of the Jews. That's it. There is one God, and he is all perfect. There is a future state of rewards and punishments. That to love God with all your heart and your neighbor as yourself is the sum of religion. Then he goes on to list the demoralizing dogmas of the Christians which have been added on. And you will be demoralized if you hear this because you're not going to like it. Number one, that there are three gods. Number two, that good works and love of our neighbor count for nothing. Number three, that faith is everything, and the more incomprehensible the proposition, the more merit to the faith. Number four, that reason in religion is of unlawful use. And number five, that God from the very beginning elected certain individuals to be saved and certain others to be damned, and that no crimes of the former can damn them and no virtues of the latter can save them. Now, which of these would you say is first three or the second five is the true and charitable Christian? He who believes and acts on the simple doctrines of Jesus, or the impious dogmatists of Athanasius and Calvin? They are the usurpers of the Christian name, teaching a counter-religion made up of the deliria of their crazy imaginations. Their blasphemies have driven thinking men into infidelity, who have too hastily rejected the supposed author himself with the horrors so falsely imputed to him. Had the doctrines of Jesus been preached always as purely as they came from his lips, the whole civilized world would now have been Christian. I rejoice that in this blessed country of free inquiry and belief, which has surrendered its creed and conscience to neither kings nor priests, that the genuine doctrine of one God only is reviving. And I trust there is not a young person now living in the United States who will not die a Unitarian. Jefferson was not a prophet. Well, you can't be bored, I think, reading this. And I really found this to be a revelation. I never knew any of this about Jefferson. I knew he wrote the Declaration of Independence, authored most of it, and I had read the Declaration. But I really had never had a sense of why he was so controversial, especially to many of the clergy, both the Anglican clergy in the South, but especially the Calvinist clergy in the North. Well, it's very clear once you read some of these letters. It strikes me, too, as interesting that, you know, Jefferson, I think, would have had a very difficult time in our own time as escaping the stigma of being a secular humanist. And I find it rather amusing that those who yell and scream so much against secular humanists have not yet thrown out both the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Because as I'm going to argue tomorrow and on Wednesday, both of those are secular humanist documents, and they both are basically Unitarian documents. And yet most of us Trinitarians have been able to live a very full and happy life in this country under them. And they really don't seem to have hurt Trinitarian religion very much at all. If anything, they seem to have tended to the great good fortune of the churches, including all the Trinitarian churches. I wonder if you have some comments. I'll save Peter Carr's letter till tomorrow. I think we have four or five minutes here.
I thought the original idea of the first settlers, though, was freedom under the when they came to this country.
It depends on what you mean by that. If you think, for example, of those who came into New England, those were one sect among the Puritans. The Pilgrims were one group among the Puritans, and the Puritans, you know, were battling for the mind of England at that time. No, the freedom they wanted was the freedom to run the show the way they thought the show should be run.
They said freedom, and they were freedom to pick the greatest and the king.
Eventually the king was even overthrown in the Great Puritan Revolution under Cromwell. No, there was great difficulty. The Quakers are among those who were persecuted all over, and they finally found haven in Pennsylvania when Penn himself, a Quaker, founded Pennsylvania. Recall Roger Williams fled from New England and began the colony of Rhode Island, which was the first colony to have had complete religious independence and was where the first Jewish synagogue was founded. There were, even for decades after the new Constitution, well into the 19th century, there were still laws on the state, on the books in some states that were very, very oppressive of Jews and forbade them from having civil offices and so forth. Because just because the federal constitution had provided for no establishment didn't mean that all the state constitutions fell in line right away. You know that Congregationalism was still established in Massachusetts and Connecticut up into the 1820s, even though as a country we had no established religion. And so that took a while for that kind of stuff to work its way out. If you were a Baptist, you were in trouble just about everywhere. If you were a Quaker, you were in trouble just about everywhere. If you were a Jew, maybe we'll suffer to have you here, maybe we won't. Catholics were, gravely suspect all over the place because everybody thought that they were giving direct allegiance to the Pope in Rome, who, remember, was still a secular power at that time. And when we looked at the Constitution clauses on Wednesday, and one of the fights over that clause in the Constitution was whether or not you had to have a religious test to hold office under the Constitution. One of the tests was to abjure the Pope. And, it's a recent argument that's just come up again as to whether we shouldn't have those who want to be judges nowadays, right? Federal judges pass certain religious tests, namely that they will rule against any sorts of legislation that appear to help abortionists, which is a rather ironic twist that it should have come to that. Freedom of religion. Jefferson definitely wanted it, see? And tomorrow we're going to talk about the terrific struggle he had in the state of Virginia to get the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom passed. That was the first big one that happened in this country. And it was only in the state of Virginia. And he had great opposition on that. He was in many ways ahead of his time. Many people had come to tolerance by this time. England had some toleration laws now already on the book. But tolerance just meant, if you're a Quaker, we won't kill you. That's tolerance. Well, that's better than hanging you, right? But it doesn't mean you can have public office, for example. It doesn't mean you can trade wherever you want to. It doesn't mean that we can allow you to pass down inheritances and be guarantors and so forth, the way we would trust other good Anglicans to be. So tolerance, yes. There was tolerance in certain measure by this time in England and in some of the colonies. But religious freedom, That was still a patchwork. That was a real crazy quote. Yeah, that's a very good question. And one I think that few of us really have done good research into. And we don't really tell our kids that much, I think, in the schools. I think we really pulled back from teaching a lot of this. We're afraid to put this kind of stuff on the table and share. It becomes terribly simplified in teaching.
Who else said it? Who else during that time was thinking along these lines with Jefferson?
With Jefferson?
Taking the generic approach to religious freedom rather than just whatever's good for my kind.
Well, I guess one of the other persons I can, Roger Williams, clearly. James Madison, of course, was very much, I think, along with Jefferson in this line of thinking. I may talk a little bit about his remonstrance that he wrote, Memorial and Remonstrance. And of course, people like Priestley and others in England. I don't know where Benjamin Franklin stood on this. You remember at the Constituting Convention, Franklin wanted a chaplain to come in, one from each of the different religious sects every day because they were wrangling so much and they weren't getting anywhere. And one morning, I don't remember if it was June or whenever, he said, I think we need to have a chaplain come in every day. And he was very open about it. He would have everyone come in. They never took him up on that. It was just totally ignored. And so.
Was Jefferson referring to the interpretation of the Bible or the different sects that interpreted it the way they wanted to?
Jefferson was referring to both. Jefferson, when he made the, did you hear what he said? He said, I took the book and I began to cut the pieces and then I pasted them on clean pieces of paper. So he actually had several copies of the Bible in front of him. And he had Latin, French, Greek, and the English Bible. And he was cutting pieces that were real Jesus and putting them together, and all the other was dross that he was throwing. For example, the first thing that went from Matthew was the virgin birth story. He thought that was rubbish and that there was that Jesus would never have claimed that for himself. That is not in there. All the stories about walking on water, miracles, raising people from the dead, all garbage. That was all garbage. It's all irrational. And Jesus himself would never have taught such things. That was all propaganda by his first followers to try and win converts and so forth. And so that, it's not merely people afterwards who built on it, but it's already in the Gospels themselves.
The original version.
Yeah, the versions themselves already. Because as he said, these were not written by Jesus himself. They were remembered by his followers and written years later. And they did what they wanted to kind of build him up. And so Jefferson is snipping it back down.
How did he decide what were the original teachings? That was what God gave him the revelation to?
Mainly, I think, because there were many other people, thinking people. This was the end of the era of the so-called Enlightenment in Europe and had come to America, touched first at Harvard and then hit other people and like Franklin and Jefferson. Many of the founders were so-called Enlightenment people. They had shared many of these thoughts and they were convinced that that Jesus must have been, if indeed he was such a great founder of religion as everybody purported him to be, and they were all sort of agreed on that. He must have certainly been as rational as they are, probably even more rational than they were. Well, if it was an offense to their rational minds to read all this kind of foolishness about virgin births and bread loaves being multiplied and fish being multiplied and people walking on water, would that not have even been more offensive to Jesus? This surely must have been something that was added by his followers, maybe for good reasons, maybe not for good reasons originally, but then which played very nicely into the hands of religious establishments later on for forcing people to agree to certain doctrines. So it was mainly a process of what they felt was sort of like cleansed thinking. Thinking that was cleansed of superstition and thinking mainly that was cleansed of being servile to authority. That was the basis of it. And there was a sense that if God gave you a mind, then in rational discussion, the truth should come out. And it is not rational discussion if you simply say, but that's what's written, and I tell you, you got to believe that. That is not rational discussion. That's an imposition on the thinking mind.